A really good introduction to my talk, which also has to do with ELR and some of the problems that we've run into in Florida. And what I wanted to talk about specifically is some of the automation that we've put in place, and even more specifically, how we've retooled some of that automation to be more flexible and more user-driven rather than being dependent on software development. This is part of the SHINE program. I'm an ITIP fellow. You can read this if you would like. Okay, so a little bit about the background and why we need to be efficient in Florida. We have nearly 20 million people, and that results in a lot of reportable diseases. It's really important for us to streamline wherever we can. We have a lot of ELRs. I threw some statistics up here. So for 2014, we had almost 400,000 ELR results. That were associated with over 90,000 cases. Actually, only about 54,000 of those cases were 2014 cases. The remaining cases were from previous years, which adds another just kind of level of complication. Associated with those 54,000 reportable disease cases, we had 64% of those that were initially identified by ELR. So that means that the first time that the county or the state health department was notified of this particular case was because of an ELR result. The percentage of cases that have an ELR result associated is a little bit higher at 71%. And let's talk a little bit about our system infrastructure. We use a system called Merlin, and that's Florida's secure web-based disease reporting system. We have a variety of data collection and management and analysis features within this system. It is limited to the reportable diseases, but excludes HIV, STD, and TB. And we're actually now migrating hepatitis out of the system as well. So this system operates in all 67 of our Florida counties. In Florida, the county health department staff are the ones who are actually doing all of the investigation and the data collection and the data entry. So they are the owners of the data. At the state health department, we support and maintain the surveillance systems as well as provide support and guidance for the county health departments. So Merlin was developed in-house. It went live in 2000, and we started consuming ELR data in 2005. So we only have 35% of our laboratories enrolled so far in ELR, which seems very low. We have a total of about 800 laboratories in Florida that are eligible for ELR, so it's a it's a daunting task. We still have a lot of work ahead of us. What is encouraging, though, is that, of course, we started with our high-volume laboratories like LabCorp and Quest. So actually 92% of the laboratory results that we're getting right now are by ELR. So I think over the past 10 years and with the advent of ELR, which has really helped us kind of restructure how we're operating within our systems, we've really had to think about what our system is doing for us. And I think we've really had a frame shift. Merlin was not originally designed to make any decisions for us. It was a place for you to go and enter your data. It was really up to the epidemiologist to interpret all of the information associated with the lab, so to read the lab, kind of determine what next steps are needed based on the information contained in that lab, whether you need to create a case, what the case classification would be based on the case investigation and the laboratory results. However, we're really moving more towards having our system do as much of the work as possible. There are still things that the epidemiologist is going to have to do. We're not obsolete just yet. But the system really can do a lot of the work that the epis are doing now. So it can review that laboratory result. It can make some decisions about the next steps based on that laboratory result. And it can also help determine the case classification. And in some cases, it can do it a lot more accurately and efficiently than the epi can. So we wanted to talk a little bit about just kind of our very basic workflow. And this is a little bit oversimplified. And I wanted to just kind of give this context so that we can kind of see where we're shoring up our process. So over on the left here, we have kind of four main routes that we can get case notifications. So the CHD can receive a paper report from a physician, and at that point they read that case report and decide whether they need to make a case and create a case within Merlin. Another route is the CHD receives a paper laboratory result. At that point, they have to enter the laboratory result into Merlin and then subsequently decide whether that would warrant the creation of a case or not. We also do receive paper laboratory results at the state level where we do data entry, and we push those laboratory results to a task list for the counties to review and decide whether to create a case. And then the last route is receive electronic laboratory results, which goes to an ELR task list for the CHD user to process and then decide whether to create a case. And then, of course, they gather additional information, and once it's deemed complete, the county reports the case. Okay, so I mentioned on the previous slide that even though we're receiving data electronically, the county user does have to actually do some processing associated with these ELR results. So in a very small screenshot over here on the right side, this is where we present the information that we received in the message. On the left side of the screen are the fields that the county user has to complete based on the information that's contained over here on the right side. So at this point, they have to decide what kind of disease this is, what the overall result is, whether it was positive or negative, whether there is strain information that's included in the lab result. And then what's not shown here is they also have to make decisions about the profile information that's contained in the ELR result and whether they want to update any existing information for that person. So there's still, we are receiving the data electronically, but there's still some work that's being done on the county user, which is not a very good use of the county user's time. That, I think, is one of the main problems. Of course, there is always a problem with the county staff not really understanding the lab results that they're receiving. We have a lot of, you know, at 67 county health departments, we have a lot of people that are receiving these labs. Most of them do not have a laboratory background. Even for us at the state level, it's very difficult sometimes to understand what the lab is really trying to tell us. So, you know, frequently, well, not frequently, but occasionally, you know, a lab or a county will see a lab for Shiga toxin, and they'll decide that that was a Shigella case rather than an E. coli case. So we run into those kind of problems. And actually, on Monday, I heard a presentation where they had reviewed the accuracy of the hand-entered data, and only about 60% of labs were getting entered entirely correctly. So it's not a problem that is unique to Florida. So then compound the problems with interpreting the lab is trying to translate the lab information into the appropriate case definition. And some of our case definitions can get a little bit intricate and a little confusing for counties to try to interpret. So we've taken a couple of stabs at trying to improve this process. The first one that I'm going to touch on is what we call smart case definitions. And this is really, what we've done is we've tried to break down the case definitions into kind of the smallest components, yes, no components. We've used logic tables based on the CST position statements, which have been very helpful, those classification tables and the statements. So we've broken down all of the case definitions into the individual components for clinical, laboratory, and epi data. And then we use that to assign the case classification based on the responses to those specific questions. So, and this is, again, a very small picture, but up here at the top, this is clinical information, and you can see a little checkbox here. So the user would check this if the person had a clinically compatible illness. We have our different kinds of laboratory tests in the next section, so the user would check which kind of laboratory test they have associated with this case. And we also have the kind of exposure criteria, so whether the person was epidemiologically linked to a confirmed case. So for we have this for all of our diseases at this point, and users check these boxes. As part of setting up these case definitions, we tell the system which combination of checkboxes should result in confirmed, probable, or suspect. So this is kind of step one. Step two is to make it smart, which means that instead of the user having to click on these boxes, the system is interpreting the information associated with the case and making that decision for the user. So this has really improved our ability to get accurate case definitions. The counties like it as well because it takes a lot of the responsibility off of them, a lot of the guesswork off of them. Okay, so our next solution that kind of incorporates the previous solution is auto processing. And we started this in 2011. So we basically are taking the ELR results that we're getting and auto processing them. So that screen that I showed a few slides ago, we're making all of these decisions in the red boxes for the users. With auto processing, we have several different tiers that are shown in this table. So I'm talking about currently the first tier, which is the auto processing of the ELR results. So we make those decisions, we process it, it goes to a task list for the county to determine whether to create a case. Our next level is to auto create the case for the user. So it goes ahead and auto processes the ELR and then creates a new case or identifies an existing case, populates the available demographic information, and if there's enough information to make a case classification, it will do that as well. And this is kind of the tier that we use for, that's most appropriate for most of our diseases. For most of our diseases, we know that we want to go ahead and create a case, but the county user is going to have to do some additional legwork to investigate the case, contact the case, get risk factor information. So most of our diseases would fall into this category. Our last category is auto-reporting the case, and this is taking it just one step further. So we process the ELR, create the case, and actually go ahead and report the case. So this is, of course, the most complete, but somewhat limited. Most of our diseases, we actually do want to do some kind of follow-up. We've implemented this for hepatitis and a couple of other diseases. So basically, to go back to the diagram I threw up before, when we auto-process ELR, we get rid of these boxes down here. When we auto-case create, we get rid of an additional box. And then when we auto-case report, we've gotten rid of this whole pathway. So we started this in 2011, as I mentioned. We started with chronic hepatitis because it's our highest volume and had some kind of complex logic to be able to flip between the acute and chronic cases. Next, we tackled salmonella. This was really kind of the simplest logic that we figured we could go ahead and do this one and use that as a building block to expand to other diseases. So we next expanded to campylobacteriosis, which did end up being relatively easy. And then we tackled another kind of more complicated one, Streptococcus pneumoniae, where we needed to be able to flip between resistant and susceptible cases. So here are the problems that we ran into. It's now 2014, and these are the only four diseases for which we've been able to implement the auto processing. So this is a very slow, slow process. And part of this is because we really tackle this on a very small level. Instead of trying to think strategically about how we can set up a process that could be used for all diseases, it was really do one disease at a time. So last year, we took a step back and redesigned our logic to alleviate the need to have software development for each disease. So it becomes driven by user-defined scenarios. So we have ended up with a job that has six steps that does all of the auto processing at once. I think the key piece on this slide, as I'm running out of time, is that we can define these scenarios based on county, provider, disease, test type, and results. Let me go ahead and jump to the next one. So this is where we have all of our rules that determine whether a case is created, should be created when we go through the process. So here's the larger picture is just our total list, and then when you click into a list, you can choose your disease, your test type, your results, and there are a couple of the other options that are defined. So a very quick overview of the process. We receive the ELR. We interpret the lab result based on the LOINC and SNOMED codes. We compare the information that we have from that lab to our scenarios to see whether we want to create a case. So an example would be Alachua County. We received a salmonella culture positive result from LabCorp. Do we want to create a case? If yes, we go ahead and create the case. We apply the smart case definition, and for those diseases where we auto-report, we go ahead and report the case. If it is not one of these, if we do not have this defined as a scenario where we create the case, we save it for currently 6 months, but we can define that time period as well. And then we have a nightly job that reviews all of the results sitting in this table, which we call the Xbox, which makes it sound like a fun video gaming system. So the nightly job reviews all of the results that are sitting in that box, and if there have subsequently been cases created, It will attach those results to the case that's been created, which has been really useful for like hepatitis, where there's negative results prior to your case, which has been hard for us to capture in the past. Okay, so getting to just conclusions, the advantages of this new approach, of course, the biggest one is that we now do not have to depend on our developers. We've created this approach that really allows us to be very flexible. We can have different tiers of automation for different counties, which has been very helpful. You know, each of the counties has their own workflows in place, and not the same amount of automation works as well for each county. And then, as I mentioned, we have the ability to store these negative results and results that currently aren't of interest, which has been very helpful. So I think the real big take-home message for us going through this process was that it's very easy to fall into the trap of making one small improvement or trying to convert this one piece of a paper process into an electronic process, rather than really stepping back and thinking long-term about how you can really redesign the whole process. We have a lot of new tools now, and I think we're, at least in Florida, we're kind of struggling with how to not just take 2 steps forward, but to take 10 steps forward and really leverage all of those tools to get away from the case-based system. And we have had a lot of positive feedback from our users. It has reduced time spent on entering labs, demographics, and creating case from 15 minutes to 1 minute. This allows me to concentrate on matters of greater priority during my workday, so I think that is ultimately the greatest success of this project. So that is all that I have.
We'd have our other three presenters come up and take a seat up here, then we'll move into our question and answer.
Great presentations, all four of you. My name is Jeff Engelon, Executive Director of CSCE, and my question is to Lauren, the VA. First, if there's a comment that would be interesting for legal analysis, is that most reporting laws are in states, and it's to the licensed physician, not to the entity that they work for. So the law will say all physicians licensed in the state shall report the list of diseases. So there should be no arbitrary federal protection just because they work in the VA under that state reporting mandate. But to my knowledge, that's never been tested. And it would be an interesting legal argument that might be answered if it were ever brought to bear. But I don't know that will ever happen because the states rarely bring physicians to court about this. The second comment is that I think both of our surveys were biased. So I think the CSDE survey that went out 6 months after the directive 2013-008, many of the respondents were biased towards the negative in that the VAs are not reporting. And I think your survey that went out a year after the directive, the VAs were biased in saying we're compliant, we're doing good work. So I think we're done with surveys, you and I. And I'd like to suggest and see what you think about really doing a study and getting data. So what I would like to do with the VA is to get into safe meds systems and see if indeed VA reporting is going up, because the provider facility should be in a NES report based on the disease entity. And I think you heard about all the great systems out there in the United States. States are developing very sophisticated reporting systems. And I think if we work together to do a study on the actual data on how many persons in VA facilities, and actually trend it out and see if the 2013 directive made any difference or not. So my question is, would you be willing to fund?
The reason I'm here is because of what you started. I wanted to be here. I got asked to be here. I got told to be here, but I wanted to be here. Because of what was started. This is VA's attempt to reach back. I am VA's attempt to reach back across the table. I'm more than willing to do whatever collaboration it would take. I've only been at VHA for a year and a half. I got tasked to implement public health reporting. I think I was the new guy. I think they said, give it to the new guy. Well, they couldn't have given it to a better or worse guy, actually, because I agree that we need to report. I really agree. I think there's a great need for VHA. And my bosses more or less do too, honestly. In fact, what we found out with our survey, that we've had enough. By the way, we're trying to get you that report. We know we haven't gotten you the report. That's a sin that we haven't gotten you our report. How are we going to do that? But what we found out is that most of the work is being done by the ICPs, the infection control. They got tasked to do another task, as if they need to do another task. But anyway, they really want to, and most of them are reporting on their own. They had no policy. They were doing it outside of policy. They were doing it on their own. They could have gotten in trouble from their supervisors. What are you doing? They did it on their own, a fair amount. And the ones that weren't doing it wanted to do it, what we found out. We do have, of course, people in the facilities that don't want to do it. No matter what we tell them in central office, will they do it? So anyway, I would be more than willing to reach out to you. I know my supervisors are more than willing to collaborate on this with you. And we will get you the report. Thank you.
My question is also for Lauren. Tracy LaPorte from the NIH. I was interested in reporting mechanisms, how you had email on the survey. And whenever I write the reporting and email, my stomach starts twisting in knots because it's not a secure way to report.
Yes.
So do you know if there was some sort of secure mail set up or if people were actually emailing out confidential information?
No. What that was, and we listed email and then the respondents responded by checking the box of email. What we think that mostly was, if you've seen the state regulations, and 50 states, District of Columbia, and territories, they're all different. What we usually found, why they were checking email specifically, there was some sort of mechanism that was set up by the states so they could send, normally they're sending back in a form. That was the email. And you notice it was small.
Hi, I'm Michael Samuel from California. Great session. And questions for Natalie from Tennessee. But one thing, it was just fabulous hearing you speak ELR and EPI. You know, it was really nice that it was so clear getting both sides of it. And I feel like some of the problems that have arisen in some instances is people, particularly more up the feeding chain, that can't. And I've been confused about a number of things. And one thing I think you cleared up for me is that an ELR message can contain multiple results. I thought it was just one result, and there was some real misunderstanding. So that's absolutely clear. Contain multiple results from what you said. And the splitting, you showed the three messages. The flat file part, is it Rhapsody that sends that to STD? Or do you do, or Rhapsody is capable of flattening it out and sending it in that kind of format to STD and?
Yeah, to some sort of delimited file.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And we just drop it and then it gets picked up.
Okay. Well, the last question is about Rhapsody. Is it, I mean, you showed the long, messy message, you showed the other complex messages as well, and we use Rhapsody in California in that kind of similar place. And is that essential, or could, given a lot of things, is there any reason to have more control over that and consider local programming for that function, or is that just way beyond, and that is the kind of tool that is absolutely necessary? Because the message you showed, yes, it's complex, but given the nature of the standards, it seems like having more control and being able to do more what we want would be good, or is that product really the way to go?
So I don't think it has to be Rhapsody. There are other integration engines that can be used. We just happen to use Rhapsody. But we can do a lot of configuration inside Rhapsody. We're able to, there's very little that we didn't do ourselves inside Rhapsody. There's hardly anything that we used out of the box, I would say. So I don't know if it's essential or not. I think we find it essential. We really liked working with it and found it really important. the first thing that you said. Thank you. But I also want to kind of give credit to my boss who's sitting right next to you, Aaron Holt, because I think our program is made up of epidemiologists who are working on informatics-related projects. And I think that really helps because we can talk to our peers, the other epidemiologists, and then we can kind of also talk to the IT people, maybe with a little bit more pushback, but we can at least speak the same language as the epidemiologists that we're representing.
And then I think I'll jump in and add a comment on that because you guys have a newer, totally different system than what we do in Pennsylvania. So the Pennsylvania system, if it got a complex message like that, by default, PA NEDS, its own workflow engine, will cope with that complex message and parse it as long as it's parsable. If the link codes are specific enough to say this is an STD in this OBX and this OBX is an HIV, those will get split to the correct program areas. We run into trouble where we use Rhapsody also in now with meaningful use getting more messages and more complex messages and some of them not so good. Rhapsody is the single best tool. So I'd say if you don't have an existing NEDS application that already can do this, you're probably much better off leveraging Rhapsody's capabilities and just putting it in there because for the most part, you're going to be able to be much more dynamic and much more flexible in reacting and modifying your Rhapsody packages than you are going into some application like NEDS and going through the whole workflow and change process to make something work.
Hi, I'm Bridget Anderson from New York State. I oversee the HIV surveillance program. And we have worked with several of our VAs so far. Any questions back to you, VA Captain? We have worked with several of our VA hospital laboratories, and so we do have laboratory reporting from several of our VAs, but not all of them in the state. And some of them have been quite reluctant to work with us. The same with the ITN. Some of them are happy to work with us, but many of them just will not even respond to phone calls at this point anymore. So, two questions. Is there someone at your level that we can work with to try to break through those communication issues we're having? So that's one. Second thing is that we, the HIV surveillance coordinators, have an annual meeting sponsored by CDC, the HIV Incidence Case Surveillance Branch of CDC. And we had a presentation last December in which someone, I can't remember the speaker's name, talked about a process of bringing all of the VAs into laboratory reporting nationally, and it was described to us as an effort that was going to be rolling out from the West Coast to the East Coast. But we were recently told, a couple of jurisdictions were recently told that that's now off the table and it's not happening. So can you help me sort out those two different issues?
Things are changing in VA. A lot of changes. Your first question, excuse me if I jump around, I think your first question was about the facilities that are reporting and not reporting and who do you come to. The buck stops here. You can, I included my contact information. I will try and get you some results. It means though that the central office doesn't have a whole lot of pull into making somebody do something in the facility level. What we try and do is educate people. This is what you should be doing because these are the regulations. And the way we can is to go, everything the directive I was telling you about puts everything back in the hands of the facility director. So the facility director then gives the task to somebody to report. And so it's the facility director who is really the key person that we have to reach. We've been reaching the ICPs who are doing implementation. If somebody isn't implementing, it's really the facility director, the boss, who will get them to do it. So that, the next persons we will go to. So it's such things as an email, it's some things as reaching their boss to get them to do it. So my name is on the slides. You can contact me or my office bug out. We will try and get you some results. Once again, we don't know how much authority we really have, but we will try. That's my path. They passed me this model path when I started working. And I didn't know what it entailed. I'm a veteran. I didn't know how big VA was. VA is huge. One thing I've learned in a year and a half, VA is huge. Your next question about, excuse me, could you just... VA's changing. they were going to roll out the Hayes system, which is going to start being done in California. That, near as I know, probably isn't going to happen. Even in California, so I'm starting in California. 10 years ago, they supposedly started. Supposedly go nationwide. My knowledge, probably not going to happen. I don't know what's going to be, what they're going to put back in, if anything's going to be put back in. Personally, it hurts. It hurts. I thought that should have gotten bigger, but it didn't. So I have no idea where it's going.
Hi, Erin Holt from Tennessee. Guys, great presentations. I think we're all doing a lot of really great work, so I'm proud of us in public health informatics. I do have a question for colleagues in Florida. Two questions, really. One, would it be possible to sweet talk our colleagues in Florida, potentially getting our hands on shareable copies of those smart case definitions?
Yes.
Fantastic. And you had a slide that had the number. I think you said something like 37% of your labs are sending ELR, but the more important number I think was that 92% represents the number of ELR volume you have. You've obviously been able to appropriately select the facilities that are going to give you the biggest, the greatest use for the suite. So, how did you guys make that decision? How did you choose which facilities to work with?
So, I mean, initially we prioritized. initially we prioritized based on volume. So we spent the first 7-8 years. Getting the highest volume facilities, and that's how we chose the next one, is who's the next highest volume. At this point, I mean, obviously that's all changed. We've gotten all of the high volume ones, and it's now just the people who want to enroll, and currently we have about 100 and some labs in testing stages right now. So at this point, that prioritization has kind of gone out the window, and it's whoever is contacting us and interested in participating. But we started very heavily with the high volume.
Would you say that it's fair that the higher volumes tended to have greater capability to participate? Or?
I don't know that I would say that. I'm not actually, honestly, as involved in the ELR onboarding process as some of our other people are, so I could definitely get more information on that. But I think there's equal capabilities kind of spread throughout the laboratory size, unfortunately.
From New Jersey. I have questions for a couple of you, and I want to thank the VA presentation. We have an excellent relationship in New Jersey. Our VA reports regularly into our online system.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
And also, I just wanted to add that recently, the VA from Delaware reached out to us and asked us how they could report to us because some New Jersey patients were over. And that was really nice because we had never heard from them earlier. Was really good because they are reaching out to us. Thank you for whatever you've done.
By the way, I would take positive comments besides only negative comments.
So we are happy. My question for Terry is, what are your thoughts on the Tennessee? In one of your slides, you had mentioned that when you get an updated message, you override whatever you have received. What if someone has already taken a public health action based on the first set of information? Because we have a fully integrated system, so the moment it comes in, it creates a case, puts it in the jurisdiction, and we have to come in and all will say we have a very enthusiastic public health workforce in New Jersey, and people are immediately on the case and working on it. So someone could have taken an action. 2 days later, you're updating it and overwriting it, and it could be contradictory information. So,
sure.
It's a legal line.
So our system actually, it does actually retain the information. What's the first visible piece in the NEDS-based system will be the most up-to-date, but it has all related
documents, basically. So it keeps a running list so that you can go back and look at what was previously received. When a new piece of information comes in, it goes kind of back into our task list, I guess. So the user knows it's updated. They can see that it's already been associated with an investigation or something's already happened with it. So it would be wonderful if our system had some sort of update trigger or field that said that this is actually an update so that the user didn't have to figure it out on their own, but we do retain all the information for them.
Because we are in the middle of redesigning our system and we're struggling with this, because what if the address information was already updated by the local health department and now we are overriding it with probably sometimes from the lab we don't have the best information, and sometimes it could just be the lab result that's being updated, and so we are seeing if we should be adding a trigger out there. This is what was reported yesterday, this was updated, please go in and check in and sign up on it that you did read the second message. So we're looking for ideas.
So we also, anything that comes in electronically into the system, like your EOR, our users cannot edit. So if it's like a snapshot in time of what was sent. So even if it doesn't come in with the address information, which can be annoying or difficult for our users, they can't actually update that lab report to put in the address information. They have to enter that in the investigation or the patient file or somewhere else in the system. So in that regard, we're not really changing anything that the user has done. We're just overriding the lab report that was previously sent. And it usually is more of an update, like another result that came in, or we got the organism yesterday and 2 days later we get the susceptibility result. Not usually big pieces of information that are actually changing.
Do you have any idea of what's the volume of updates it results? Because we've asked our ELR partners not to send us updated or corrected results, so we don't know whether it's like 2% or is it 20%, and
can I maybe throw a side question maybe to that, is where you're deciding to do these overwrites, is that after you've decided that you've deduplicated this patient and you know for sure this patient is the same one before you overwrite that record? Is that kind of like, I guess maybe I'm thinking a sidetrack of that is like, how are you already deciding you've got the right patient to append to or overwrite their record?
It looks at a couple pieces of information to decide whether it's pretty much the same, it's the same lab event that it needs to overwrite. And this isn't something that we develop. This is Nesbitt system functionality. And there's four fields. It's like specimen collection date, the sender, the ordering,
okay,
lab. I mean, there's a couple different pieces of information that say this is the same lab event that needs to be overwritten. And it's just overriding the lab. That's the only part of it that is, and it's maintaining it. For corrected results or updated results, I have no idea what the percentage is, but I do think it also depends on the sender, because some senders are sending updated results even maybe when they shouldn't. I'm looking more towards hospitals, not our labs that we work with, but the hospitals, there are just like triggers in their system that they're sending updates. I don't know if they should be when they are, but
it really changes the patient file.
And it just updates.
Because we don't update or overwrite anything once it's been sent to us, because, as I said, someone could have taken a public health action, and that's what the lab sent us. So, but we use that same information to create the case, because ours did not make it case creation for fully integrated systems. So everything except for HIV and TB are outside of our system, STDs and all of them. So it does take the address information from the lab report to create the person, the case, so that then we can find the right jurisdiction. And I just had a question from Pennsylvania that you guys have already got a TB program in.
Since 2007. Thank you, because that's one program.
Hi, Carmen Pugh from Rockport.
And we're out of time. No. And we're out of time.
So back in 2014, Florida state regulations required that we report all negative hepatitis. So I'm curious, when there is a positive hepatitis test, that means that a patient potentially has hepatitis, we also send all of the corresponding negative results. What does that do with your system? How do you distinguish between a patient who has one positive hepatitis and perhaps two negative hepatitis B, versus a patient who has all negative? What does your system do with that information? In other words, are you sending on those negative test results along with the positive test results?
So we are, I mean, we, all of those go into our system. We don't do anything with the negatives until there is a positive.
Okay.
So we store those results. Currently we're storing them for 6 months, but we can store, we can set that, it's arbitrary. We can set that at any amount of time. We can set it for 18 months. We store those until after that time frame, and every night we're checking to see if there are subsequent positives that have come along and resulted in a case being created, and if there are previous negatives, they will get associated with that case. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
It's nice to meet you in person. I see your name all the time.
Hi, Leah. Tamara Hinsberg with the California Department of Public Health. And I'm interested in the how you have your DLR over-processing based on the user-defined scenarios. And who are the users who define those scenarios?
So that is, I'm glad you asked that question, and I kind of ran out of time there towards the end, so I didn't get to talk as much about that as I would like. But those are admin users. So it's not any user can go in and make these updates. It happens at the state level. We can update them based on requests from the county users, but it's an admin function. And, you know, we have maybe 8 or 10 admin users at the state level who are able to make those decisions.
Hi, I'm with HIV Surveillance, and my question is for the Tennessee. Our NEDS program doesn't really want to make a lot of changes in the Rapid State program, and so I'm not able to process them if we're moving into NABEN. Is it actually agreed to give us remote access to the Rapid State? So I'm just curious what other changes you are currently making in them besides like splitting up the labs, like for labs that are missing like SNMED code, and do you do that sort of changing as well?
For HIV or just in
general? HIV or STD.
Yeah, we do a lot in Veracity. It's not just splitting with messages, that's really just one piece. I think the main reason that we use Veracity is to check the messages to make sure that they're following required fields are there and things like that. There's a lot of checks in place. In terms of generating the file for EHARs, but you're moving towards Maven?
We're moving from, we're integrating HIV, STD, and TB into Maven. And the problem is we'll be processing the raw, H07X and all files. And we had previously been doing a lot of cleaning in that. And so that isn't so willing to do any additional cleaning in there. And so the workaround is you can have access to it yourself in Veracity, and just kind of curious what's possible.
I mean, it's possible to check for is there a SNOMED code? If not, have a table that you can populate. I mean, the possibilities are kind of endless in Veracity based on who you have that can handle that kind of programming. I don't know if that's the best answer, but.
Okay, so we're down to pretty much our time. Are there any final questions? Okay, then two things. Anybody that works with Carmen should find her and hug her. And secondly, could we just make a nice round of applause for our presenters today?